Chapter 32.
Canyon, the Spanish Conquistadors. Few romances are more fascinating than the history of the early exploitations of this continent by the Spanish conquistadors. Cortes, Pizarro, Guzman, Narvaez, Coronado are names to conjure with. The wonderful successes of Cortes naturally excited the jealous envy and cupidity of his compeers. In his earlier experiences, Cortes had aroused the anger of Velasquez, governor of Cuba. Cortes, in one of his many acts of gallantry, had betrayed the sister of Velasquez's mistress. When Velasquez learned the facts, he peremptorily commanded Cortes, who was his subordinate, to marry the unhappy girl. Refusals and imprisonments, threats and anger were the natural consequences, and, while Cortes did ultimately marry her, the enmity thus engendered bore bitter fruit for the husband. Breach between Cortes and Velasquez. When Cortes made his effective conquests on the mainland and sought to supplant Velasquez, the breach between the two men considerably widened. Both sought, with embassies, the ear of the King of Spain, Charles V, and while the future conqueror made a deep impression with his reports of conquests to come, and treasures already in hand, the governor's friends were not slow to act. Meanwhile, Cortes had hit upon the bold plan of destroying his ships, and thus compelling his men to march to the subjugation of Mexico. Velasquez was about to dispatch Panfilo de Narvaez with a commission as captain general to arrest him, and send him in chains to Cuba. The king, however, would not permit this, and Narvaez was sent forth charged to be friendly to Cortes. But this was not to be. Events prevented, and Narvaez finally decided to place Cortes and his whole army under arrest. This was a great undertaking, and required skillful generalship, as well as boldness and skill in execution. Though a gallant warrior, Narvaez was not equal to the task he had set himself, and Cortes, having learned what was before him, turned the tables upon Narvaez and his force, by becoming the arrester instead of the arrested. It requires no great knowledge of human nature to picture the fierce anger of Narvaez and his men. When Cortes eventually released them, it was on condition that he be left alone, and that Narvaez return to Spain. The defeated man, with anger burning his jealous heart to a white heat, did return, and immediately demanded of the king some mission that should allow him to remove the disgrace from his name. To get rid of him, the king sent him to the conquest of what is now Florida. Expedition to Florida. It was a brave expedition that set forth on a bright day in June, 1527. 5 ships and 600 men made quite a showing, yet the Atlantic Ocean, aided by storms and winds, flouted and routed them, so that it was April of the following year before the main part of the expedition landed at Tampa Bay. Of the total destruction of the party, save Cabeza de Vaca and 3 or 4 others, all readers are fairly familiar, as they are likewise of de Vaca's wonderful 8 years' journey across the continent. Arrival at San Miguel. I have thus rapidly traced these events in the early history of the exploration of this continent, for it was the wanderings of Cabeza de Vaca, and his final arrival at San Miguel in New Galicia, that brought the incident over into Arizona, and led to the discovery of the Grand Canyon. Preliminary reconnaissance. The Viceroy of New Spain at that time was Antonio de Mendoza, a wise, loyal and far-seeing man. He was anxious to checkmate Cortes, and to show that others besides the great, though treacherous conqueror, could make discoveries of new lands, where gold was abundant, and where colonies could be established. Yet he would not be rash. Before sending out a large expedition to conquer the cities and fertile land Cabeza de Vaca had described, it would be wise and cautious to send a cool-headed man, one who was prepared for any hardship, one who had no lust for gold in his own soul, yet who could be relied upon to bring back a straight and true story to the viceroy as to whatever he might discover concerning de Vaca's stories. He should be accompanied by Stephen, the Negro, who was one of de Vaca's companions, and thus he would be accurately guided to the places that had been described. The man chosen for this important reconnaissance was a devoted Franciscan, Fray Marcus, to whom I have devoted the next chapter of this book. Marcus went, saw, returned and reported, and upon his report the expedition of Coronado was equipped and fitted out. Coronado's army. The fervor with which the Spanish gallants joined Coronado's army of exploration is realized when one remembers that 300 Spaniards as well as 800 Indians were gathered together in a few days. Coronado was a Spanish grandee, traveling at the time of de Vaca's arrival as a royal official visitor. In the words of Castaneda, he was gentleman from Salamanca, who had married a lady in the city of Mexico, the daughter of Alonso de Estrada, the treasurer and at one time governor of Mexico, and the son, most people said, of His Catholic Majesty Don Ferdinand, and many stated as certain. And the same historian later on continues, in his simple and naive way, to tell us about Tovar and many others, when the viceroy, Don Antonio de Mendoza, saw what a noble company had come together, and the spirit and goodwill with which they had all presented themselves, knowing the worth of these men, he would have liked very well to make every one of them captain of an army. But as the whole number was small, he could not do as he would have liked, and so he appointed the captains and officers, because it seemed to him that, if they were appointed by him, as he was so well obeyed and beloved, nobody would find fault with his arrangements. After everybody had heard who the general was, Coronado, he made Don Pedro de Tovar ensign general, a young gentleman who was the son of Don Fernando de Tovar, the guardian and high steward of the Queen Dona Juana, our demented mistress, may she be in glory. A brilliant and gallant company. After the naming of their officers, Castaneda regrets that he has forgotten the names of many good fellows. It would be well if I could name some of them, so that it might be clearly seen what cause I had for saying that they had on this expedition the most brilliant company ever collected in the Indies, to go in search of new lands. But they were unfortunate in having a captain who left in New Spain estates and a pretty wife, a noble and excellent lady, which were not the least causes for what was to happen. First disappointment. Poor Coronado. The reader is thus prepared to throw upon him the blame, because similar treasures to those found by courts in the land of Montezuma were not found in Arizona and New Mexico. In spite of his having so many fine gentlemen in his official family, Coronado's disappointments and disillusionments began early. As he reached the region where the wilderness began, just past the Pima country, he felt downhearted. For, although the reports were very fine about what was ahead, there was nobody who had seen it except the Indians who went with the Negro, and these had already been caught in some lies. Meeting with Indians. When the expedition first came in contact with the Indians of the desert region, the gallant members of the party must have been a little scared, for, according to Castaneda, some Indians during the night in a safe place yelled so that, although the men were ready for anything, some were so excited that they put their saddles on hind side before, but these were the new fellows. When the veterans had mounted and ridden round the camp, the Indians had fled. Coronado reaches Zuni. Coronado finally reached Cibola, the mythical, now known to be Zuni, in New Mexico. Here he was not only disappointed, because he did not find the great treasure so long anticipated, but he was wounded. Getting in to converse with him, the Indians told him of the people who lived round about, and among others, of those who dwelt in the province of Tusayan. And here is what Castaneda tells us about the discovery by Europeans of those whom we now know as the Hopi. Castaneda's account of their experiences in the canyon. The general had sent Don Pedro de Tovar to these villages with 17 horsemen and 3 or 4 foot soldiers. Juan de Padilla, a Franciscan friar, who had been a fighting man in his youth, went with them. When they reached the region, they entered the country so quietly that nobody observed them, because there were no settlements or farms between one village and another, and the people do not leave the villages except to go to their farms, especially at this time, when they had heard that Cibola had been captured by very fierce people, who traveled on animals who ate people. This information was generally believed by those who had never seen horses, although it was so strange as to cause much wonder. Our men arrived after nightfall, and were able to conceal themselves under the edge of the village, where they heard the natives talking in their houses. But in the morning they were discovered, and drew up in regular order, while the natives went out to meet them, with bows and shields, and wooden clubs, drawn up in lines without any confusion. The interpreter was given a chance to speak to them, and to give them one warning, for they were very intelligent people, but nevertheless they drew lines and insisted that our men should not go across these lines toward their village. While they were talking, some men acted as if they would cross the lines, and one of the natives lost control of himself, and struck a horse a blow on the cheek of the bridle with his club. Friar Juan, fretted by the time that was being wasted in talking with them, said to the captain, "To tell the truth, I do not know why we came here." When the men heard this, they gave the Santiago the battle cry of Spain, so suddenly that they ran down many Indians, and the others fled to the town in confusion. Some indeed did not have a chance to do this, so quickly did the people in the villages come out with presents, asking for peace. The captain ordered his force to collect, and, as the natives did not do any more harm, he and those who were with him found a place to establish new headquarters near the village. They had dismounted here when the natives came peacefully, saying that they had come to give in the submission of the whole province, and that they wanted him to be friends with them, and to accept the presents which they gave him. This was some cotton cloth, although not much, because they do not make it in that district. They also gave him some dressed skins and some cornmeal, and pine nuts, and corn and birds of the country. Afterward they presented some turquoises, but not many. The people of the whole district came together that day and submitted themselves, and they allowed him to enter their villages freely to visit, buy, sell, and barter with them. It is governed like Cibola, by an assembly of the oldest men. They have their governors and generals. This was where they obtained the information about a large river, and that several days down the river there were some people with very large bodies. As Don Pedro de Tovar was not commissioned to go farther, he returned from there, and gave this information to the general, who dispatched Don Garcia Lopez de Cardenas with about 12 companions, to go to see this river. He was well received when he reached Tusayan, and was well entertained by the natives, who gave him guides for his journey. They started from here loaded with provisions, for they had to go through a desert country before reaching the inhabited region, which the Indians said was more than 20 days' journey. After they had gone 20 days, they came to the banks of the river, which seemed to be more than 3 or 4 leagues above the stream which flowed between them. This country was elevated and full of low, twisted pines, very cold, and lying open toward the north, so that, this being the warm season, no one could live there on account of the cold. They spent 3 days on this bank looking for a passage down to the river, which looked from above as if the water was 6 feet across, although the Indian said that it was half a league wide. It was impossible to descend, for after these 3 days Captain Molgosa, and one Juan Galeras and another companion, who were the 3 lightest and most agile men, made an attempt to go down at the least difficult place, and went down until those who were above were unable to keep sight of them. They returned about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, not having succeeded in reaching the bottom on account of the great difficulties which they found, because what seemed to be easy from above was not so, but instead very hard and difficult. They said that they had been down about 1/3 of the way, and that the river seemed very large from the place that they reached, and that from what they saw the Indians had given the width correctly. those who stayed above had estimated that some huge rocks on the side of the cliff seemed to be about as tall as a man, but those who went down swore that, when they reached these rocks, they were bigger than the great tower of Seville. They did not go farther up the river, because they could not get water. Before this they had to go a league, or two inland every day late in the evening in order to find water, and the guide said that, if they should go 4 days farther, it would not be possible to go on, because there was no water within 3 or 4 days, for when they travel across this region themselves they take with them women loaded with water in gourds, and bury the gourds of water along the way, to use when they return, and besides this, they travel in 1 day, what it takes us 2 days to accomplish. This was the Tizen, Firebrand, River, much nearer its source, than where Melchior Diaz and his company crossed it. These were the same kind of Indians, judging from what was afterward learned. They came back from this point, and the expedition did not have any other result. On the way they saw some water falling on a rock and learned from the guides that some bunches of crystals which were hanging there were salt. They went and gathered a quantity of this, and brought it back to Cibola, dividing it among those who were there. They gave the general a written account of what they had seen, because one Pedro de Sotomayor had gone with Don Garcia Lopez as chronicler for the army. The villages of that province remained peaceful, since they were never visited again, nor was any attempt made to find other peoples in that direction. Plus described by Cardenas unknown. There has been some attempt on the part of students who are familiar with the country, to locate the spot where Cardenas and his men gazed down into the depths of the canyon of the Colorado River. The long distance traveled, according to Castaneda's narrative, was totally unnecessary to bring the Spaniards to the banks of the river. 20 days' journey, through a desert region, away from Tucson in the direction of the Colorado River, would have brought them as far down as Umar-Mohave. But at these points there is no canyon. It is well known that the canyon system terminates near the Great Bend, some miles beyond the Grand Wash, hence this could not have been the objective point of the guides of Cardenas. D'Lenbaugh's opinion. D'Lenbaugh, in his Omens of the Colorado River, argues that the Tucson of Castaneda could not have been the land of the Hoppus, for, as he truthfully remarks, an able-bodied man can easily walk to the brink of the Marble Canyon from there in 3 or 4 days. He also says that it has usually been stated, without definite reason, that Cardenas reached the Grand Canyon about opposite Bright Angel River, or near the spot where El Tovar Hotel now stands. I have never heard this statement made by anyone who has any knowledge either of Castaneda's narrative, or of the relative locations of the Hopi towns and the Grand Canyon. Evidently a Hopi stratagem. The Hoppus of today, with whom I have talked, insist upon it that Cardenas was taken to the barren and desolate point near the junction of Marble Canyon, the Little Colorado Canyon and the Grand Canyon. Here, the river may be said to come from the northeast, and turn toward the south-southwest, and the conditions are not at all like those described by the historian. But if one accepts this modern statement of the Hoppus, he is met with the questions. Why make Cardenas travel 50 leagues, to see an inaccessible river, that could be reached in 3 or 4 days? Did Cardenas really travel 50 leagues? I do not know, but I hazard the conjecture that the Hoppus gave Cardenas as much wandering about as they could, took him to this terribly bleak and barren spot, where even today one can scarcely prevail upon a Hopi or Navajo to guide him, in order that he might be discouraged from making further explorations in the neighborhood. The Hoppus had no use for explorers or strangers. They had suffered too much from foes, for too many decades, to welcome anyone who seemed eager to possess anything of theirs, and, in my judgment, their treatment of Cardenas was a deliberate ruse to get rid of him. They had a trail over which they habitually traveled, that brought them to Uethawali, the White Rock Mountain, opposite base camp, and on to the Havasupai villages. Several times a year they went to and fro over this trail. It crosses the Little Colorado, where it would have been easy to show the Spaniards the salt spring, to which Castaneda later refers. There is another point on the river, some miles beyond base camp, where the Hoppus used to visit the Havasu Pass, and that is just beyond the Great Curve, where the river may be said to flow from the northeast to the south-southwest. But both at base camp, and at this point, the Havasu Pass had made trails down to the river, of the existence of which the Hoppus may, or may not, have known. So I freely confess that, as yet, I have not settled in my own mind at what point Cardenas and the Spaniards gazed into the depths of the Great Canyon. Alarcon's discovery of Colorado River. While the main portion of Coronado's army had been advancing eastward, a sea force sent out to cooperate with Coronado, under Alarcon, had sailed up the Gulf of California, and had entered the Colorado River, thus solving the problem of its exit into the Gulf. To Alarcon, belongs the discovery of the Colorado River, which he named the Buena Gaya. He went up the river twice in boats, the second time ascending possibly as high as 100 miles above the mouth of the Gila. Finally he entered between certain very high mountains, through which this river passeth with a straight channel, and the boats went up against the stream very hardly for want of men to draw the same. He claims to have passed above this place undoubtedly one of the lesser canyons of the Colorado found below the Needles, where the Santa Fe Railway crosses the river, and here magicians tried to destroy him and his party by setting magic reeds in the water on both sides. Of course this failed, but Alarcon decided to go no further. Here he erected a very high cross, on which was carved a statement to the effect that he had reached this spot, so that if Coronado's men should find it, they would know he had ascended the river thus far. Town of San Hieronimo is established. In the meantime, a small force of 70 or 80 of the weakest and least reliable of the men of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.